historicengland.org.uk/disability history.
For historical accuracy, this research has used language in the context of the time period being explored. Words used to describe different types of disability at different times can sound offensive to modern ears. During this recording, we'll explain the definitions of these words as used at the time.
Disability since 1945. This section looks at how attitudes to disability changed after the Second World War. The National Health Service extended treatment, and disabled groups campaigned for equal rights, inclusion in society, and access. The end of the Second World War. As the Second World War ended in 1945, many horrors emerged. They included the mass killing of disabled people in Germany. In reaction to Nazi abuses, the pre-war eugenicist theories, which had argued for the isolation and sterilization of people with disabilities, became increasingly reviled. In England, public concern shifted to the 300,000 ex-servicemen and women and civilians who had been left disabled by the war.
Sterilization, surgical procedure to make men or women infertile. Advocated by the eugenics movement for people viewed as mentally and sometimes physically or morally degenerate or deficient.
Rehabilitation for all. The 1944 Disability Employment Act promised sheltered employment, reserved occupations and employment quotas for disabled people. Initiatives to restore the fitness, mobility, daily living skills and morale of disabled servicemen and women spread to the rest of the disabled population. The new National Health Service extended rehabilitation services to workers disabled by industrial accidents.
Reserved occupations, an idea introduced in legislation after the Second World War, where certain jobs, such as lift attendants or car park attendants, were reserved solely for people who have some sort of disability. Intended to boost employment of people with disabilities. Daily living skills. The skills seen as necessary to be able to live an independent life, such as cooking, eating, budgeting, shopping and traveling. Restoration of daily living skills is often the focus of rehabilitation programs.
Direct action. Disabled people did not remain passive, and many campaigning disability charities formed in the 1940s and 50s. A new social movement was started by a silent reproach march of disabled ex-servicemen in 1951. In the 1960s and 70s, the civil rights movement in America inspired disabled groups to take direct action against discrimination, poor access, and inequality. A social, rather than a medical, model of disability emerged, and eventually, in 1995, the Disability Discrimination Act was passed. Inclusion and access. The new social model was concerned with people's rights as members of society. The question of access was critical. Disabled people needed adaptations made to their environments if they were to be properly included. Separate facilities were built at first, but soon architects and planners took on the idea of universal design. They created buildings and landscapes which every person could use every part of.
Social model. The social model of disability argues that while physical, intellectual, or social variations can cause individual limitations or impairments, it is society's failure to take account of these differences and include people that causes disability. The idea developed between the 1960s and 1980s in opposition to the medical model of disability. Access. The features of a building or area such as ramps, sliding doors, toilets, etc., which ensure that it can be used by people with disabilities.
The birth of the Paralympic Games. Great changes took place in sport. The inspirational refugee neurosurgeon, Ludwig Gutmann, 1899-1980, was in charge of Stoke Mandeville Hospital in Aylesbury, Buckinghamshire. Here, patients paralysed in the war began to compete against each other as part of a pioneering rehabilitation method. In 1948, a wheelchair archery competition was held on the lawns of the hospital. In this humble way, the Paralympic Games was born. The Games are now the second biggest sporting event on Earth, and many elite disabled athletes have become sporting icons in their own right.
More information about Stoke Mandeville Hospital at http://www.parscape.org. http://www.org.uk/hob.asp(x?hob_id=105-72700).
The end of the asylum. The era of the asylum finally came to an end after a series of scandals revealed neglect and abuse. In 1981, the Jay Report promoted a Care in the Community program for people with learning disabilities and mental health needs. Tens of thousands of people left the long-term hospitals and returned to mainstream communities. The Victorian ideal of a safe institutional asylum has been replaced by new visions of equality, inclusion, and universal access. Their long-term impact will be seen in time.
Asylum. Form of institution, particularly for mentally ill or learning disabled people, which creates a fully segregated environment set apart from mainstream society. Began as charitable institutions in England in the late 18th century, built and provided by the state from 1815. Care in the community. A system of care and support for people with disabilities and people with mental illness based on the belief that people should live in their communities rather than in separate institution. The Care in the Community Green Paper of 1981 signaled the end of the asylum era.
Back to the community, disability equality, rights and inclusion. This section describes the struggle for disability equality, rights and inclusion, which began in earnest after the Second World War, and which led to the end of the asylum and the policy of care in the community. The start of the new militancy. In 1946, the National Cripples Journal denounced the government's promise of security from cradle to grave, claiming that it did nothing for the civilian cripple, who is incapable of earning a living. If there was going to be a bold new society fit for all, disabled people must be a part of that all. Parents and family-led organizations. Many new campaigning organizations sprang up, at first led by parents and families. In 1946, the National Association for Mental Health and the National Association of Parents of Backward Children were formed, later becoming MIND and MENCAP respectively. The Leonard Cheshire Foundation, British Epilepsy Association, the Spastic Society, now Scope, and hundreds of others soon followed.
More information about the National Association for Mental Health at https://www.mind.org.uk/help/research_and_policy/history_of_mind-the_national_association_for_mental_health. More information about the National Association of Parents of Backward Children at http://www.mencap.org.uk/about-us/our-history. More information about the Leonard Cheshire Foundation at http://www.lcdisability.org/question-lid=19. More information about the British Epilepsy Association at http://www.epilepsy.org.uk/about/history. More information about Scope at http://www.scope.org.uk/about-us/our-history.
Campaigns by disabled people. Disabled people themselves began to campaign. In 1951, 800 members of the British Limbless Ex-Servicemen's Association took part in a silent reproach march to 10 Downing Street. Then in the 1970s and 1980s, campaigning organisations of disabled people came to the fore. The Union of the Physically Impaired Against Segregation UPIAS, the Mental Patients Union MPU, and For People with Learning Disabilities, People First. Disabled MPs. Two wounded First World War veterans who both entered Parliament, the double amputee Jack Brunel Cohen, Liverpool Fairfield, and the blinded Ian Fraser, Morecambe and Lonsdale, Lancaster, fought for disabled ex-servicemen's rights. The deaf MP Jack Ashley, Stoke-on-Trent South, campaigned for the rights of disabled people generally. A new social model of disability. In 1968, the American academic Wolf Wolfensberger, 1934-2011, denounced asylums and long-stay hospitals as abusive institutions. Their design and their routines dehumanized people. From the 1970s, disabled campaigners such as the sociologist Michael Oliver and disability studies pioneer Vic Finkelstein, 1938-2011, at the Open University in Milton Keynes, advocated the social model of disability. In this model, disabled people control their own lives, challenging non-disabled society. Tara Flood, Paralympic swimmer and director of the Alliance for Inclusive Education, ALLFIE, has spoken of the importance of the social model for disabled people as part of the How Was School project.
More information about the How Was School project at https://howwasschool.allfie.org.uk.
Public disquiet. After the Second World War, long-stay hospitals for people with learning disabilities and mental illness seemed neglected and forgotten. From the 1960s, abuse scandals erupted onto newspaper front pages, triggering inquiries at Ely Hospital in Cardiff, Farley Hospital in Flaxbourton, North Somerset, and Cold Harbour Hospital in Sherborne, Dorset. A famous television documentary, Silent Minority, exposed further scandals at St. Lawrence's in Caterham, Surrey, also known as Caterham Lunatic Asylum for Safe Lunatics and Imbeciles, and Borough Court in Reading, Berkshire. Public disquiet became overwhelming.
More information about Farley Hospital at https://historicengland.org.uk/listing/the-list/the-list/entry/113793. More information about Cold Harbour Hospital at https://www.heritagegateway.org.uk/gateway/results_single.asp(x?mark)uid=5B5B41834-41CE-4156-94EC-2D7BC49C39829. Resource ID equals 19191. More information about St. Lawrence's at https://www.heritagegateway.org.uk/gateway/results_single.asp(x?mark)uid=62FF826E-FF99-47BB-A3E7-2C918B33A39A. Resource ID equals 19191. More information about Borough Court at https://historicengland.org.uk/listing/the-list/the-list/entry/118080805.
Care in the community. The 1981 Care in the Community Green Paper signaled the end of the asylum. Over the following two decades, tens of thousands of people moved back to the community from the hospitals. A new era of residential and group homes, daycare facilities, and independent living within mainstream communities began. ALFIE have created a video archive, How Was School, containing interviews with disabled people on their experiences. Themes include experiences within mainstream schools and the expectations people had of disabled children.
Watch the video about experiences within mainstream schools at https://howwasschool.allfie.org.uk/audio/i-didn't-know-what-was-possible. Listen to the podcast on expectations at https://howwasschool.allfie.org.uk/audio/early-life-expectations.
21st century ideas. Thinking continues to evolve. In the new century, ideas of empowerment and self-direction have taken the lead, in which disabled people acquire a personal budget to buy support, rather than receive, care. The idea of specialist homes and buildings is challenged. Many believe there should be universal design for universal buildings. we find ourselves at the end of the asylum period, an era which only represents 140 years of disability history, and which never involved all disabled people. But the long shadow of Bedlam remains. How will places for people with disabilities develop in the future? Disability, rehabilitation and work. This section explains how work became a key element of the rehabilitation process for people with disabilities after the Second World War. As well as promoting their recovery, being able to work meant that they would be less dependent on the state. Treatment during the Second World War. The treatment of seriously injured, burned and disabled soldiers and civilians during the Second World War centered on returning them to the war effort. If that was not possible, it might at least reduce their dependence on state or voluntary assistance for the rest of their lives. Importantly, this meant that disability was no longer seen as an obstacle to employment, at any level. The most famous example of this was the acceptance of Douglas Bader, 1910-1982, as an RAF pilot, despite his having lost both legs in a flying accident in 1931. Fitness, mobility and purposeful activity. This new approach led to new ideas in the field of rehabilitation. Medical and surgical interventions came to be seen as just the first part of a longer process aimed at restoring fitness, mobility and daily living skills and combating depression through purposeful activity, including work. The physiotherapy profession grew enormously. There were significant advances in the design and manufacture of artificial and prosthetic limbs, particularly at Roehampton Hospital in South London.
Rehabilitation, a process of medical and other interventions to enable people who have become disabled through accident or injury, or who have experienced mental illness, to recover skills and functions they have lost, to aid their recovery and reintegration into society. Physiotherapy, a healthcare profession which seeks to repair or improve impairments and disabilities through the promotion of mobility, functional ability, and quality of life by physical intervention. Prosthetic limbs, the use of artificial replacements for missing body parts, particularly limbs. More information about Roehampton Hospital at https://gateway.org.uk/gateway/results_single.asp_x?uid=D95 6EE21-1D94-45CB8D26-9924C9FF6A2 &C9. Resource ID equals 19191.
Rehabilitation for all. By 1945, a network of convalescent and rehabilitation centers for disabled ex-servicemen and women had grown up around the country. Gradually, the new theories of rehabilitation were applied to the civilian disabled population. In 1946, the Egham Industrial Rehabilitation Center in Surrey opened to civilians. It offered vocational guidance and purposeful training, particularly in building work, shoe repair and retail distribution. Roffey Park in Sussex specialised in supporting workers with mental health issues. St Dunstan's in Regent's Park, London, continued to work with blind ex-servicemen, as did the Royal National Institute of Blind People, RNIB, with the rest of the blind population.
More information about Egham Industrial Rehabilitation Centre at https://www.heritagegateway.org.uk/gateway/results_single.asp_x?UID=D95 6EE21-4567034C9FAEC23644F80 4C8 7C& Resource ID equals 19191. More information about Roffey Park at https://www.heritagegateway.org.uk/gateway/results_single.asp_x?UID=57D1877-7954-4A4C-8A79-A74732A46 8DD2 ampersand. Resource ID equals 19191. More information about St. Dunstan's at https://www.heritagegateway.org.uk/gateway/results_single.asp(x)?UID=65D9A64-1195B-4177-93F3-63741C-E6307-4 Ampersand resource ID equals 19191.
The National Health Service, NHS. The NHS, created in 1948, had taken over most rehabilitation services by 1951. Amongst these was the Miners Rehabilitation Service, which included centres at Berry Hill Hall near Mansfield and the Hermitage in Chesterle Street, Durham. In the 1960s, the Daily Living Research Unit at Mary Marlborough Lodge, based at the Nuffield Orthopaedic Hospital in Oxford, pioneered new rehabilitative techniques in daily living skills and new designs in wheelchairs and appliances.
More information about Berry Hill Hall at https://historicengland.org.uk/listing/the-list/list-entry/120714. More information about the Hermitage at https://www.heritagegateway.org.uk/gateway/results_single.asp(x)?UID=65C963D-8B-D-464B-BE44-32543128-2DAF& resource ID=19191. More information about Mary Marlborough Lodge at https://www.heritagegateway.org.uk/gateway/results_single.asp(x)?UID=3FEBAC63-6F64-4903-8AE8-6029366D09A& Resource ID equals 19191. Daily living skills. The skills seen as necessary to be able to live an independent life, such as cooking, eating, budgeting, shopping, and traveling. Restoration of daily living skills is often the focus of rehabilitation programs.
Sheltered work settings. Work was seen as crucial both for rehabilitation purposes and to reduce dependence on the state in an era of labor shortages. Following the Disabled Persons Employment Act of 1944, a network of factories was established, initially known as British Factories and later renamed REMPLOY. The first factory was set up in Salford, Greater Manchester, in 1946. By 1953, there were 90 factories employing 6,000 disabled people. Products included woodwork, leatherwork, mats and brushes. In Bristol and Halifax, stump socks were manufactured for amputees. Veterans also worked in the Omega Electric Blanket Factory in Ashted, Surrey. Employment Registration Scheme. Outside these sheltered work settings, the government set up a registration scheme that required employers to take on a certain percentage of disabled workers. Occupations such as lift operator and car park attendant were reserved for disabled people.
Sheltered work. Work for disabled people taking place in specialist work settings separate from mainstream workplaces.
Inclusion in mainstream employment. Later in the century, doubts arose about the effectiveness of sheltered work. There was now a drive towards bringing disabled people into mainstream employment, in line with the idea of their full participation in mainstream life. High-profile disabled people such as politician David Blunkett, scientist Stephen Hawking, and athlete Tanny Gray-Thompson have reached the top of their professions. Yet unemployment amongst people with disabilities remains a serious issue. Nowhere out of bounds. Disability access and adaptation. This section looks at how the increased numbers of disabled people living in cities after the Second World War made mobility and access issues vitally important, and how architecture and design began to meet the challenge. Mobility and access. From 1945, the English landscape rapidly became more urbanized. The existing disabled population was increased by 300,000 war-disabled people, and mobility and access in towns and cities were now urgent issues. How could disabled people work and participate in society using the complex buildings, difficult entrances and exits, steps, stairs, curbs, busy roads and transport systems of the modern urban environment?
Access. The features of a building or area such as ramps, sliding doors, toilets etc., which ensure that it can be used by people with disabilities.
Design for the disabled. At this time, barely any buildings were designed with disabled people in mind. Then in 1956, a young newly qualified architect called Selwyn Goldsmith, 1932-2011, became disabled through polio, and he devoted the rest of his life to overcoming what he called architectural disability. He challenged the institutional discrimination of buildings which placed barriers in the way of disabled people who wanted to use them. And not just people using wheelchairs, but also blind people, deaf people, the walking disabled, indeed anyone who had difficulty negotiating buildings. His Designing for the Disabled, 1963, was the first guidance for architects on disability access, and it quickly became an indispensable teaching aid for architects and local authority planners. It is still used today.
Polio. Poliomyelitis, infectious viral disease affecting the central nervous system, which can cause temporary or permanent paralysis. First identified in the 19th century, there were major epidemics across Europe throughout the 20th century. A common childhood disease and cause of disability in England until its eradication through a vaccination program, which began in the 1960s.
New initiatives in Norwich. In 1964, Goldsmith selected Norwich as a representative English city and went to live there for 3 years. He interviewed 284 people with disabilities, asking them which types of building should be made easier for disabled people to use. The highest priority by far was public toilets. The other types of building mentioned, restaurants, local shops, churches, reflected the desire of disabled people simply to lead the ordinary lives that other people led. Goldsmith's interviews resulted in England's first unisex, disabled access public toilet, on Castle Hill in Norwich. 15 ramped curbs around the city, a feature invented by Selwyn, now standard around the world, and a revised edition of a Designing for the Disabled. Direct action. Disabled people began to campaign for independence. Ken and Maggie Davis designed the pioneering Grove Road housing scheme in Sutton-in-Ashfield, Nottinghamshire. This was Britain's first integrated cooperative housing development and allowed disabled and non-disabled people to live alongside each other. People also took the fight to the streets. In the 1990s, DAN, Direct Action Network, demonstrated against inaccessible public transport and buildings. Government regulation constantly pressed building owners to ensure that all public buildings were accessible and contained suitable facilities, and this became law with the Disability Discrimination Act, 1995. The concept of universal design. A shift in principles then took place. Instead of adding special facilities to a normal building, the concept of universal design emerged, in which any person with any disability was entitled to use every part of a building. Hove Town Hall in West Sussex was unique in the 1970s as it was designed with a flat entrance for the mayor's disabled wife. It was one of the first buildings to win a Disabled Access Award, introduced by the Department of the Environment in 1976. The Richard Attenborough Centre for Disability and the Arts in Leicester provides a modern example of a complex but accessible multi-story public space. Architectural competitions now include accessibility as a key component for any award. The winner of the 2011 Sterling Prize was the Evelyn Grace Academy in Brixton, South London, a multi-level mainstream school on a cramped inner-city site, fully accessible throughout.
Universal design. Architectural approach, which seeks to ensure that buildings are fully accessible in all parts to anyone with any sort of disability. More information about Richard Attenborough Centre for Disability and the Arts at https://www.heritagegateway.org. https://gateway/results_single.asp_x?marq_ID=D19TD1A-A-F-E6-47C6-8E72-45-2D27EE5EBC-resource ID=19111.
Nowhere out of bounds. The impulse of much design is now not just about people being able to get into buildings, it is about them being able to get anywhere. In 2004, new design and landscaping features made the Tower of London, a World Heritage Site, accessible. Boscombe in Bournemouth, Dorset, has England's first disabled access beach huts. Goldsmiths' fight against architectural disability lives on. The Alliance for Inclusive Education, ALLFIE, has created How Was School?, a video archive of interviews with disabled people about their school experiences. Themes include access and adaptation.
More information about the Tower of London at https://www.heritagegateway.org.uk/gateway/results_single.aspx?marq ID=36643E05-7D6C-447896-6F-D7 0DB6B8 1A7F ampersand resource ID=19111. More information about Boscombe at https://www.heritagegateway.org.uk/gateway/results_single.aspx?marq ID=6F9405-CF-84DD-40E-F-8784-5601416604B5 Resource ID=19111. Watch the video about the battle to get into a local mainstream middle school at https://howasschool.allfie.org.uk/audio/the-caterpillar-contraption. Listen to the podcast describing the difference between going to a local school and residential special school at https://howasschool.allfie.org.uk/audio/from-freedom-to-regimentation.
Disability and sport, the birth of the Paralympics. From rehabilitation to world-class performance. This section tells you about Ludwig Guttmann, Stoke Mandeville's first director, who used sport as a central element in his revolutionary rehabilitation system for people paralyzed in the Second World War, and how an archery competition in 1948 led to the birth of the Paralympics. Ludwig Guttmann. During the Second World War, 12 spinal units were set up around the country, including Stoke Mandeville Hospital, Buckinghamshire. Its visionary director, Ludwig Guttmann, 1899-1980, a German-Jewish neurosurgeon and refugee from Nazism, made the first significant breakthrough in the rehabilitation of people with spinal paralysis. Previously, such people had been seen as hopeless cases.
More information about Stoke Mandeville Hospital at https://www.heritagegateway.org.uk/gateway/results_single.aspx?marq ID=524BD53C-1536-4CF29FE286864BF4A2 Resource ID=19111.
Guttmann's rehabilitation system. Guttmann introduced not only an improved medical regime but also a rehabilitation system designed to restore hope and a sense of purpose to the young people whose minds and bodies had been damaged by their injuries. Sport played an important part in this, making use of the competitive instincts of the young patients who had led active lives before their disabling injuries. Competitive activity at Stoke Mandeville developed, from darts, skittles and snooker competitions in local pubs, to ball throwing, wheelchair polo, wheelchair netball and archery. The birth of the Paralympics. It all began in 1944 with a competitive dressing exercise on what was known as Ward X at Stoke Mandeville. The war-injured, paralyzed young men on the ward raced each other to get up from their beds, get dressed and into their wheelchairs. On the 29th of July 1948, the opening day of the Olympic Games in London, an archery competition took place on the lawns of Stoke Mandeville against a team from the Star and Garter Residential Home for War Disabled People in Richmond, Surrey. There were 16 competitors, including two women. Gutman predicted that one day it would become the disabled person's equivalent of the Olympics. In 1950, the games were named the Stoke Mandeville Festival of Sport, and 10,000 people watched a wheelchair netball match at the Empress Hall in West London. People with disabilities caused by industrial accidents, many of them miners from the north of England, began to take part. In 1952, the games became international, and by 1966, in Rome, 400 disabled athletes from 22 countries were participating. As part of the Alliance for Inclusive Education, ALLFIE, project, How Was School? Tara Flood, Paralympic swimmer and director of ALLFIE, has spoken about her first experiences of swimming lessons.
Listen to the podcast at https://howwasschool.allfie.org.uk/audio/swimming-lessons. More information about Empress Hall at https://www.heritagegateway.org.uk/gateway/results_single.asp(x)UID=953635F9-E97C-472-82FC-5080E1E2CF&
Philip Craven, disabled world-class athlete. In 2001, Philip Craven became the president of the International Paralympics Committee. Paralyzed aged 16 in a rock climbing accident, he subsequently became one of the finest wheelchair basketball players in the world. He was motivated, not by the desire for medical rehabilitation, but by a hunger to become a world-class elite player. Led by Craven, the formidable Great Britain wheelchair basketball team became world champions in 1973. Under his leadership, the transformation of the Paralympics gathered pace, moving away from the idea of medical rehabilitation and towards the idea of world-class performance by elite athletes. The Paralympics today. Today, the Paralympics are the second biggest sporting event in the world. At the 2012 London Games, 4,200 disabled athletes participated in 20 sports in a stunning range of fully accessible, universal design venues. The Games are no longer just about the rehabilitation of paralyzed people, they are a great international sporting event in their own right. Other famous sporting venues have opened up to disability sports, including Wimbledon, where wheelchair tennis is now played. Gutman's vision, in a quiet corner of Buckinghamshire in 1948, has been realized in a way that even he may not have imagined possible.